I want to begin by noting that what we now call the theology of the body was initially a series of Wednesday catechetical addresses by John Paul II, in which he delivered, you know, the Pope has an audience every Wednesday and he gives a speech. And so John Paul gave a speech on these topics virtually every Wednesday from 1979 to 1984. So 5 years of Wednesdays. Okay. Now, that was interrupted twice. One of those years was a jubilee year for the Blessed Mother, and I forget which year that was. And then, of course, the assassination attempt on his life caused him to interrupt the Wednesday catechesis. So that's the first thing to note, that these are catechetical addresses, which means that they're intended to catechize. In these addresses, he's attempting to educate Christians. He didn't write the theology of the body hoping to convince non-Christians. And so the theology of the body takes scripture as its starting point. In the theology of the body, John Paul is not interested, for the most part, in making philosophical arguments for the truths that he presents, even though he considered himself primarily a philosopher. Throughout his early career as a priest, his early life as a priest, Karol Wojtyła had become concerned that theology and philosophy had become too abstract and too disconnected from human experience. That's why you often hear Wojtyła or John Paul referred to as a phenomenologist. It's true that he dabbled in phenomenology, the philosophical school of thought that emphasizes human experience in the process of human thought, but it should also be said he didn't do so uncritically. So even though he's interested in reconnecting theological and philosophical thought with human experience, or at least speaking theologically and philosophically in ways that would connect with the lives of the faithful, he is no relativist. He still believes in objective morality because he's a follower of Jesus Christ, right? And Christians believe that the world makes sense, that creation makes sense, and that we can learn from it. Christians believe that God makes sense, that revelation is reasonable, even if it is at times mysterious. The theology of the body has several treatises or themes. I'm just going to list them, name them for you. There is a catechesis on the book of Genesis. There's a catechesis on the Sermon on the Mount. There's a whole theme treatise on St. Paul's teaching on the human body. There's one on the resurrection of the body. He moves then into virginity for the sake of the kingdom. And then he offers reflections on the sacrament of marriage. And then the theology of the body concludes with reflections on humanae vitae. Now, this morning, I'm just going to focus on the catechesis on Genesis, which is the first catechesis and really the core of the theology of the body, with some reflections on John Paul's understanding of the resurrection. I'll be interspersing some Thomism in there because, well, I just can't help myself. So, and John Paul was a Thomist. So the theology of the body. The scriptural foundation for the theology of the body is really the creation story that's found in the second and third chapters of Genesis. Remember, there's really two creation stories in Genesis. Genesis 1, God creates the world in 7 days, but chapter 2 begins on the day that he put the man in the garden. So we all know that story. God creates man, places him in a garden, and then sees that it's not good for the man to be alone. And after bringing all the animals to the man, God creates the woman to be his partner. For John Paul, and this is a direct quote, chapter 2 of Genesis constitutes in some way the oldest description and record of man's self-understanding, and together with chapter 3 is the first witness of human consciousness. So he sees the Genesis narrative as a sort of inspired account of man's self-understanding before God. Now, this touches on how revelation happens. You know, we as Catholics don't believe that it's dictated, that it happens within sort of historical events and within the community, right? And so Genesis 2 and 3 for John Paul is, in fact, a record of an early self-understanding of man And because it's inspired, we can therefore even give it a higher value as Christians. The primal experience of man revealed in Genesis is what John Paul refers to as original solitude. He is alone. And he draws two conclusions from this solitude. First, and this is a quote, created man finds himself from the first moment of his existence before God in search of his own being, in search of his own identity, in search of his own definition. What this means for John Paul is that every person is engaged in a subjective search for an objective identity, for who we are. Who we are by accepting and living out the identity and vocation that God has in fact hardwired or inscribed into our very existence. The second conclusion that John Paul reaches from the Genesis narrative is that self-knowledge goes hand in hand with knowledge of the world. The reason the man realizes he is alone is because he realizes he's different from all other creatures. He's not the same as the animals. The body, John Paul teaches, plays a significant role in this realization. For John Paul, it is the human body that reveals to the man that he is different, and it's the structure of the human body that permits us to be the author of real human activity. I mean, it's everything from having opposable thumbs, to being able to walk upright, to being able to think and imagine and create. The human body is responsible and implicated in some ways necessary for all of these activities. This is precisely why he says that Adam's first reaction upon seeing Eve is in fact not to notice their differences, but to notice that she is like him. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. They are the same. So this is one of the central themes of the theology of the body. The body expresses the person. The body communicates the person. And, you know, this connects in many ways to Thomas's understanding of the human person, his hylomorphism. I mean, it's a relevant characteristic for his strict hylomorphism, the theory that the body and the soul are so united, so intertwined, that they are, in a sense, codependent on each other. For St. Thomas, the human person is not just a body, not even just a soul. The human person is a body-soul composite. So it's completely wrong to think that John Paul was the first to emphasize this. The theology of the body isn't radically new in this sense. Aquinas had already realized that these two principles, body and soul, are inextricably linked to the human person's activity. The body is the material in us, and the rational soul is the formal. What makes our body to be the human body is the soul, which is the form of the body. In many ways, the body we share with the animals, but the soul gives the body distinctive human activity, its higher side. The body is made for the soul, but this doesn't mean that the body is a mere instrument for the soul, even though the soul can live without the body. The human soul is such a substance for Aquinas that it needs the body to be complete. And his insistence upon this fact is consistent throughout his life. For example, he holds that there is an immaterial element of human thought that can't be explained simply by the chemistry of the brain. He would not use that language. That's my language. Thought is the work of the soul. Abstract thought is the work of the soul. If he were alive today, he'd point to the fact that neuroscience is really still unable to explain the big ideas that people come up with. I mean, you can get a scan of certain parts of the brain that light up, but ideas like love and freedom and God, I mean, these things aren't just synapses firing in the brain. And yet Aquinas would not deny that the material part of us has a role in our abstract thought, that it's through our body that our mind takes in information, sights and sounds and tastes and so forth. And it's our body that is the principle of contact between the soul and the world. And so Aquinas would not have been surprised to learn of the many things that we now know about how the brain works. He's so consistent that the human person is a composite of body and soul that he argues that after death, when our soul is separated from the body and is, God willing, united to God in the beatific vision, the soul is still some sense lacking because of its ordering to the body, which is why the resurrection is a thing, right? The soul is made for the body. Our souls are such that we don't become angelic spirits You know, we're not caught in a shell here. The body is not incidental. So for Thomas and St. John Paul II, the body plays a major role in the person and in the importance of the relationships we have with ourself, with others, between the sexes, and certainly with God. And that's exactly what sort of distinguishes our personhood from the personhood of God, from the Trinity, and the personhood of the angels. We are embodied persons for St. Thomas and for the Catholic tradition. Now, returning to St. John Paul II, the creation of woman now means that mankind has two complementary ways of being body, and therefore two complementary ways of being male and female, or being human, male and female. This complementarity then has a special meaning for the body when man and woman come together in the conjugal act. The human body and its male-female complementarity has what John Paul II calls a spousal attribute, a spousal meaning, which is to say the body is directing the person to the other in a gift of self. And the conjugal union, he says, carries within itself a particular awareness of the meaning of that body in the reciprocal self-gift of the person. The body wants to give itself to another person. It's directed to that. Now, there's a deeper reason for that. It's for St. Thomas, it's because the human person is directed outward to the other in a gift, and it has to do with creation. Here's John Paul's words. Genesis introduces us into the mystery of creation, that is, of the beginning of the world by the will of God, who is omnipotence and love. Consequently, he says, every creature bears within itself the sign of the original and fundamental gift, which is the gift of existence. Creation is a gift because man appears in it, who as an image of God is able to understand the very meaning of the gift in the call from nothing to existence. And so the uniqueness of humanity is not only that we are called from nothingness into existence in a gift, because all creation is moved from nothing into existence. The uniqueness is that we can understand that fact and can understand that truth. And therefore, we can understand that this gift has a directionality to it, that we're called out of nothingness into existence. And that directionality is moving then us to another person, to a community of persons, and ultimately to communion with God, the divine persons of the Trinity. You see, there's a directionality that we can see and understand. And the body is a witness to this gift because it is also a witness to the love from which the original gift of creation springs. So men and women, through their bodies, are able to live this gift with each other in a very unique way. The physical differences between the sexes are certainly ordered to procreation. But for John Paul, the body's meaning and value goes beyond biological procreation to the expression of love, to the expression of this communion. And so the spousal meaning of the body concerns not only procreation, it concerns the communion of persons in love, in marriage. And so for marriage in the theology of the body is not intended merely for biological procreation, but in fact, something much larger of which procreation is a part, an essential part, which is to say, marriage helps to propagate the gift of creation through the gift of self from one generation to the next. Mothers and fathers are procreating and propagating the very gift of existence with God to future generations. And that's why procreation is so important, because it's a sign of the fruitfulness of the communion and love of the spouses. So the communion of man and woman, he said, had been intended to make man and woman mutually happy through the simple and pure union of offering themselves. And through that experience of this gift of person, by subordinating the union to the fruitfulness and procreation, opening themselves up to even greater awareness and greater purpose. So now the shape of the Pope's project in these catechesis becomes clear. The human person, whether a man or a woman, created in the image of God through a gratuitous gift from that same God, is unique in all of creation. because the person can understand that gift. This uniqueness stems from the fact that we are free persons engaged in uniquely human activity and called out of ourselves toward a communion with one another and ultimately with God. And so human existence, even though it is characterized by a certain existential solitude, separating man from all other creatures, is nonetheless marked by a drive to others. And in the case of marriage, to one other in particular. And this drive to the other is manifest in the human body just as much as it's written in our existence. The drive for the other, this capacity for love and self-gift, that's what John Paul means by the spousal meaning of the body when you hear that language. Now, at the beginning of time in that Genesis narrative, John Paul says that Adam and Eve, man and woman, understood this intuitively and simply. They would have had an intuitive understanding of the meaning of their own bodies. They knew that they were made to be a gift to each other. Original sin ruins all of that. That's the bad news, right? After sin, the body no longer is as effective in communicating the person to the world. Sin introduces concupiscence, unmoderated sensual desire, which is in fact a threat to the whole structure of the person because concupiscence threatens our self-mastery, being masters of ourselves. And with sin, our bodies revolt against our personhood. We're constantly experiencing a certain revolt of the body. I mean, how much of our culture today really has a problem with the body, either overemphasizing it on the one hand or underemphasizing it on the other? John Paul would say all of this is from sin. We're no longer masters of our bodies, our sensual desires. We're no longer completely free in that regard. And if we do not have the interior freedom of self-mastery, then we cannot, in fact, make a simple gift of ourselves, precisely because you cannot give what you do not possess. And if you do not have self-possession, you cannot give yourself. And so that's the battle. Our very nature craves the other, looks to the other in order to be gift to the other. But concupiscence also means that we're always craving, always desiring the other for ourselves, and we're never, in fact, satiated and satisfied. So this desire combined with concupiscence means precisely that the simple union of man and woman now becomes insatiable. Your desire will be for your husband. This union does not completely satisfy. The interior struggle of our body's impulses can alienate us, in fact, from our body. The body becomes something else than that which contributes to my personal identity, to my being. It becomes something separate from me. I mean, I think we see this play out in the culture all the time, right? That I'm not my body, or my body doesn't represent me. And so it's not surprising that the spousal meaning of the body, the inherent direction of the body to the other, is now also confused by sin. After original sin, given the alienation of the person from the body, John Paul says, becomes a sort of territory of domination. And the spousal meaning of the body is no longer apparent to people intuitively. It's no longer apparent that the body is a gift, in fact, and is meant to be a gift. And so after sin, John Paul says that the task of men and women is to, and this is a direct quote, to reconstruct the meaning of the body, to reconstruct the meaning of the reciprocal gift of self. And he says this takes great effort. The inherent spousal meaning is not destroyed by sin. The body can still communicate. But because of sin, our communications with our body are now distorted. And that's not just in the conjugal act, but that's all of our communication. I mean, the ability to lie, the ability to put on a good face when in fact we're angry or sad, the inability we labor under to communicate honestly with each other. All of this is original sin. And that's why we need Christ's redemption. So, original solitude, sin, another theme in the theology of the body is the redemption. In the theology of the body, as in the rest of the Christian tradition, redemption is not only about salvation, it's about redeeming the body. Building off of St. Paul's observations in chapter 5 of the letter to the Ephesians, "Husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church," John Paul notes that in giving his own body and sacrifice for love of the church, his bride, Christ's redeeming love can also be characterized as a spousal love. The redemption by Christ, therefore, he says, recreates the spousal meaning of the body in us. Now, just to be clear, the idea that the body needs to be redeemed is in no way to imply that the body is evil. Far from it. But redemption, the Pope said, points out only to man's sinfulness, by which he lost, among other things, that clear sense of the spousal meaning of the body, in which the interior dominion and freedom of the spirit can finally express itself. And so we need the redemption of the body, Christ's own offering of his own body, to receive the healing grace necessary to regain the freedom over our own sensual cravings in order to make a true gift of ourselves to the other. In John Paul's view, he says, man must seek the meaning of his existence and the meaning of his humanity by reaching all the way back to the mystery of creation, but through the lens and the reality of the redemption. And he says, it's only there that we find the essential meaning of what the body is and what the person is. You can see here a common theme in John Paul's entire pontificate, which he borrows from Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 24, that the grace of Jesus Christ reveals to us not only what it means to be God, but also what it means to be human. Right? Redemption culminates in the next life, in which men and women will then participate in the inner life of God himself. This kind of exchange with God is the fruit of grace. He says grace is God's self-communication in his very divinity, not only to the soul, but in the next life to the whole of man's psychosomatic subjectivity. And this is why the Lord teaches that there is no marriage in the world to come. The spousal meaning of the body, redeemed in Jesus Christ, in the end, in the beatific vision, is in fact divinized into what John Paul calls the virginal meaning of the body. Because when we're united to God in heaven, we will make ourselves a complete gift to God, and God will make himself a complete gift to us, body and soul. And so this, by the way, is where consecrated religious and priests figure into the theology of the body as a sign of that virginal meaning of the body that one day all of us will have in the beatific vision. The language of the body, another overriding theme in the theology of the body. So even though the spousal meaning of the body is proceeding toward this virginal meaning through the redemption in the hereafter, nonetheless, in this life, marriage remains the primary place that the spousal meaning of the body is lived. It's in the marital act that the spousal meaning of the body is on full display. You see, it's precisely because the body has meaning, a drive to the other, that the body, for John Paul, also speaks a language of its own. Men and women use their body to communicate with one another and the world. We use facial expressions, we use words, and so forth. The body communicates, and the conjugal act is a communication between spouses. The problem is that because of sin, communicating with the language of the body, even in the conjugal act, is no longer that simple. Because of sin, because we're alienated from our bodies, we no longer communicate directly. And so John Paul says that couples have to work, and the words he uses here is always this, to reread the language of the body, which is to say, to work to regain the objective meaning of what the body is doing and communicating, and to make that their own communication. All of this goes back to the fact that for Wojtyła, once again, like the great philosophical and theological Catholic and Christian tradition before him, the body is an objective reality that must be respected, even in the marital bedroom. The body is not incidental to who we are. So when we communicate with our bodies, we are truly communicating, and we're the authors of what we communicate. But our body communicates with a language that is inherent to nature and to the structure of the human person. The body's language should communicate in the marital act the spousal meaning of the body, the gift of self. But because of sin, this language is often can be corrupted by individuals and even by spouses acting together and jointly. Individuals and spouses can act at cross purposes to what the body is naturally trying to communicate. When we communicate with each other, when couples communicate with each other, they must communicate in the truth. And so John Paul says that, and this is a quote, if the human being in marriage, and indirectly also in all other spheres of mutual life, gives to his behavior a meaning in conformity with the fundamental truth of the language of the body, then he is in the truth. In the opposite case, he commits lies and falsifies the language of the body. So you might be able to see now where all of this is going. In their interactions, couples must always use their bodies in ways that are not contrary to the truth and must always communicate truthfully. The truth of the consent, especially exchanged on their wedding day, which is the truth of complete and radical self-gift. You can see how even in, like in an examination of conscience and after having heard confessions for 15 years as a priest, you can have married couples confess, I mean, even things other than the conjugal act, but in which married couples might confess or a married person might confess withholding affection or being selfish in certain parts of family life, right? Because there's something not truthful about that, right? That everyone's always working on. I mean, religious, we also have to work on not being selfish in our own lives with each other, right? And so when couples, for example, use contraception, for John Paul, they're essentially lying to each other. They're speaking lies to each other with the body because they're withholding a very essential aspect of their bodies, which is their fertility. So for him, it has nothing to do with barriers. It has to do with speaking truthfully to each other. And so for John Paul, Paul VI's famous line that the unitive and procreative dimensions of the conjugal act are inseparable is true for John Paul because the unitive is communicated through the bodily procreative. And the procreative is the fruit of the unitive. You can't have one without the other. You can't tell your spouse, I love you, and at the same time withhold something from your spouse, something so essential of you. Attempting to communicate the unitive without the procreative is not, in fact, unitive. So the moral theologian is going to say to the couple who's using contraception that, in fact, they're not as happy and loving as they think they are because they're withholding something from each other, even if they both agreed to it. It's a lie that doesn't respect the objective reality of the body and the structure of the human person. And to my mind, all of this, of course, is really the point of the theology of the body. I mentioned this last night, and John Paul says this as much. It's the whole thing is a commentary and a defense of that paragraph in Humanae Vitae. In 130 catechetical audiences, John Paul is arguing that the body communicates in a way that is not arbitrary, but is dependent on an objective reality given by the Creator that has to be respected. The objective structure of creation cannot be sacrificed in favor of experience or sensuality or psychology. It can't be sacrificed to what we might call the subjective experience of being human. And so while John Paul has been concerned to incorporate human experience in theology and philosophy, he hasn't jettisoned, obviously, ontology and objective ethics. Now, however, I will say in the theology of the body, he never really goes into the objective or ontological structures of the human person. That wasn't really his project. And he says that much in the beginning. He's not interested in these catechises of exploring philosophical truths. He wanted to provide a biblical anthropology that could, in the end, not only support but defend the church's understanding of marriage and sexuality. And of course, a lot has been written popularly about the theology of the body, not all of it great. I'm not even sure all of it's accurate. But it's also true. The temptation of a lot of popularists is to turn it into a catch-all for everything. That wasn't John Paul's intention either. Right? You know, for instance, he never really mentions children in the theology of the body. Believe it or not. I mean, how do you do the theology of the body without, even as much as I've just been talking about the conjugal act, he didn't intend it to be a catch-all, which is why it needs to be read in the context of everything else of his pontificate and his life. And so that's my overview of the theology of the body in like 40 minutes or 50 minutes, whatever it was. So thank you so much.